Okay, Mr. Chairman, if I understand that, then that in a existing project that's maybe financed for $2 million and a $1 million expansion is contemplated, then that you'd end up, if it were financed, let's say, for a hypothetical example, if that project were financed at present to the tune of $2 million through, or in the future, by AIDA, and you want to come in for project expansion, you would have to find another borrower to finance the $2 million worth of existing debt or participate in for $2 million in a total $3 million loan. Is that how it would work? Or how it would work?
No.
Mr. Chairman, it might very well be that the existing bank holding an existing mortgage of $2 million would participate and simply rewrite, pick up the refinancing portion. In other words, they would then hold a note or a portion of the note for $2,100,000 for the existing financing plus 10% of the project expansion. So,
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to beat this to death, but the as I understand it, then the way this would work is that if how would this work if I had a project, which I don't, but if I had a project that was financed by a $2 million project that was financed by by AIDA, and I would have then $1.8 million worth of AIDA financing, and I wanted to go to a for a $1 million expansion, what would happen? Would I be eligible for any AIDA financing on that project?
The way I understand this language, Mr. Chairman, you would. The question of whether or not outstanding debt would have to be refinanced outside of the AIDA is severable from the question of whether or not the borrower would qualify for financing for the expansion from AIDA.
I didn't want to take that and double check.
Mr. Chairman? I agree that it is severable. I think the question is whether, you know, how much, whether we want to do that or not. For instance, in this $3 million project, maybe that is contemplated, well, I'm trying to figure out how the AIDA financing works so I can get the $3 million. It seems to me that under terms of the bill, that you could come in, Mr. Chairman, and get a $2.7 million commitment from AIDA and $300,000 worth of financing someplace else and take the project off my hands and put the expansion in at the same time you did the acquisition. I mean, if I'm reading the bill correctly, which... And, Mr. Chairman, I think the question is whether or not we want to do that. So I guess specifically then the question I would boil it down to is what are the major policy reasons for the elimination of refinancing of existing debt from project cost.
Mr. Chairman, this was a request of AIDA last year, and the statute that was drafted last year was supposed to take care of that. This language is required to make it perfectly clear. The reason it was requested was because of the obverse of Mr. Malone's example, where somebody's got a $10 million project and wants to have a $1 million expansion primarily for the purpose of refinancing all of the debt. And the people who operate the Alaska Industrial Development Authority and the Department of Commerce last year came in because they were concerned that if refinancing were allowed, that the volume of requests, the dollar volume of requests, would essentially soak up all of the money that would be available that they had. And so it was designed to prevent that from happening. Essentially, it's a provision that keeps the price of poker on this from going up too high.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions? Further discussion on the motion to report the bill out, Mr. Meekins?
Mr. Chairman, since we had some discussion, I just wanted to point out I have at least three concerns. One is a due on sale clause. I sort of feel like they should people should be allowed to make assumptions. And the 3-year versus 7-year, I'd like to go back to. That's out.
That's not in this draft.
Okay, and the so that concern's taken
care of. That was the only instructions they got from me, Mr. Meekins, was I don't want to hear any more discussion about none, 3-year sapphire.
And the other thing is the question of multifamily that Representative Miller was so concerned about.
Mr. Miller has informed me that it is his intention to address that when the bill comes to the floor, and I think that's fine. Further discussion on the motion to report the bill out? Hearing no objection, it's so ordered.
Mr. Carney? I'd like to move the amendment that I pass out as a committee amendment to this bill to be presented with the bill.
We want those presented to this committee
at the end.
Is there objection?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Mull?
I presume all people on the committee have seen the amendment, but I don't know if anyone else has.
I think you did.
Perhaps it would be good to read the amendment.
Yeah, maybe you should. I have a copy of it here somewhere.
Before we adopt the amendment, Mr. Chairman, could you give an explanation of Mr. Carney?
Okay, you have a copy of the amendment?
Already.
Does everybody have a copy of the amendment Mr. Carney had offered?
Well, Carney, the reason for the amendment is that there are some telephone electrical utilities that are reaching the $10 million mark, and as a result of that, they would not be eligible to borrow. And this amendment simply rectifies that situation for them.
My only concern, Mr. Chairman, is that it raises the borrowing power to $20 million, isn't it, rather than the usual $10 million that was provided for in the bill?
Just for these people, doesn't raise their...
Just for those...
It doesn't raise their borrowing power.
What it does is that we have in the law now gross revenues or gross volume of business limitation on small business, which I think is $10 million, right?
That's really good.
And in the case of these operations, they're regulated in their earnings, so they can have $11 million of gross sales and maybe $100,000 worth of earnings. And so what it would do is increase the gross sales for those types of operations to qualify from $10 million to present to $20 million gross sales. Basically, what I'm right now.
Further discussion, Representative Buckle?
Okay.
Was there objection to the amendment? Hearing none, it's ordered. Why don't we take about 5 minutes? I don't mean 15 or 20. Let's take about 5 minutes recess to get there. Before we start on 25. We'll start. I expect will be quite some time on public hearings on the energy bills. I asked Mr. Gardner if he would come up and testify, and I would assume would be the best one to start with, Mr. Gardner, 25?
Yeah.
All right. Would you make yourself comfortable there and see if you can educate us, especially me. The rest of them are probably pretty well clued in, but I'm certainly not.
Chairman, members of the committee, I think maybe I would briefly just for a couple minutes to explain the package of bills that came up from resources that are on Senate titles and how they fit together before I go into Senate Bill 25. Basically, you've got Senate Bill 25, which is the statutory authorization program for the financing mechanism, both for energy projects and for the power production assistance program, modifications to that program that were passed by the legislature last year, which is aimed at assisting in basically in the rural areas and those other communities which have extremely high energy costs that we have no immediate solution for. Senate Bill 26 then is the actual appropriations bill that appropriates funds to the various projects from A to Z on energy. Then Senate Bill 244 is a bill that deals with redesignations of previous loans, and basically as this passed the Senate, as part of their program, it was a forgiveness of loans that had previously been made on hydroelectric and other power projects. And that's the bills that sort of
construct the packages that came out of House Resources Committee. Now, Senate
Bill 25
is probably where the controversy is. When the committee started with it, there was basically sort of three proposals on the table. There was the governor's bill, which proposed as a financing mechanism of a mix of per capita calculated grants, revenue bonds to give some kind of market test, and a cost overrun mechanism to complete construction of projects. That was the financing mechanism envisioned. There is something on the order of, say, 30% to 40% grants for the energy projects. They treated all energy projects, not just hydro. The governor also introduced amendments to the power production assistance program to make work more efficiently and more fairly. The Senate passed legislation that would have basically, through a grants program, built select hydro programs and anticipated that there would be a total of $5 billion appropriated by 1985 to complete the hydro program, although in fact the Senate passed bill did have appropriation items in it for other things besides hydro, money for the Fairbanks Anchorage intertie, some people used to refer to as the Sioux Sittin intertie, and some $40 million worth of rural energy projects that were unspecified, and appropriations for power production assistance programs. So all the bills have some mix of energy appropriations in them. But the and then also was more or less the House proposal at that time that was more or less the existing program, which is that the legislature set up the Alaska Power Authority to use the power projects revolving loan fund funded by the state and to basically make low interest loans and then also to sell revenue bonds to build projects. And the proposal at that time of the House Resources Committee was to put the appropriation that was being called for on the order of, say, $500 million into the revolving loan fund and make like 5% interest loans to the projects for construction of those projects, and that would be for alternative energy projects, inner ties, hydroelectric, or whatever type energy project. Okay, so anyway, there was a lot of squabbling back and forth between the House and Senate over there. So what you have before you now is a proposal that was originally proposed by Speaker Duncan as somewhat of a middle ground between the House, Senate, and the governor, and this is the so-called equity payment program. So that's what you have in Senate Bill 25. Now what it does is it sets up a power development fund in the Alaska Power Authority. The legislature would appropriate money for specific projects to that fund to be constructed. The projects would be constructed and owned by the state through the Alaska Power Authority and the Power Development Fund. The Power Authority then would have the ability to lease those facilities for operations out to a municipality or what in the bill is defined as qualified utility. The legislature, to a great extent, would maintain control over the fund. And that was some interest on the governor's part in maintaining that. So if there was a cost overrun or something like that, the legislature would have to appropriate more funds. Also, the investment of the power production, the power project fund, would be done by the Department of Revenue in accordance with the same criteria the general fund is invested for. the interest income would be deposited in the general fund, and in the bill it says it may be appropriated to the fund by the legislature, but it would not, the interest off the fund would not automatically go back into the fund. So it would be a separate fund that the legislature would appropriate money into for specific projects, but the legislature would have to designate the projects and would have to, if money was unused, it would have to be reappropriated by the legislature. The interest income would have to be appropriated by the legislature. If there was any funds, they would lapse to the general fund. So the legislature maintains control, and to that extent the administration does. Okay, now what the projects, as I said, would be built, owned, and controlled by the state. And the question of the payback mechanism. It's not really constructed as a payback mechanism. What is called for in the legislation is that between now and July 1st, 1986, there. Let me track that. What it starts out with is that the projects pay a 5% flat fee to the state. That's 5% of the total cost of project. And the way the bill is constructed, that would include, say, previous loans or feasibility. It would be the total amount of money the state has put into the project. It would be 5% of that cost would be paid. Then there's a provision that if the legislature has not appropriated $5 billion to the Power Development Fund by July 1st, 1986, then that would convert to a 10% rate. Now, this was something the Senate was interested in and was similar to the provision they had in their bill. Okay, then there's a second provision on page 5 of the bill that says after the effective date of this act and until June 30th of the fiscal year, which the power production capacity of all power projects acquired or constructed by the authority under the energy program for Alaska exceeds 500 megawatts. And it's probably, it's not going to exceed 500 megawatts until Susitna or some project of that magnitude would go online. It wouldn't necessarily be have to be Susitna. There's another large project, Chakatamna, that we call for a feasibility study to be done that would be in the 300 to 400 megawatt range itself. Then at that point, instead of being a fixed 5% rate, it would go to a rate established on an annual basis. Okay, now back up a little bit. The allocation of that 5% would go for number one, operation, maintenance, and equipment replacement, which is will vary on each facility. But so in other words, that 5% is paid by the whoever is purchasing the electricity. They pay 5%. Let's say it's a $100 million project. They're paying $5 million a year back to the state. Okay, then money is appropriated then by the legislature for the operation and maintenance of that $100 million hydroelectric facility. Okay, and that, on an average, is estimated to be about 1.5%. Now, depending on the individual facility, maybe it would be 1% or 2% or 3%. Of course, that would change over time. The operation and maintenance facility is not going to be a fixed cost, and it is going to vary with the facility. But in terms of the calculations we received from the Alaska Power Authority, they said it would average 1.5% there. So I would say that $5 million paid in annually, $1.5 million would actually go back for the operation and maintenance of the facility. That's not just the local utility, but the actual power facility itself. Okay, then the rest of the fund would be used to fund, also included is any debt service or safety inspections, which not really of that much magnitude, but the main thing that would go towards the other, say, 3.5% on average, would go towards the annual cost of the power cost assistance program. And this is a program the legislature set up last year basically as a short-term subsidy for those rural areas which are paying, say, 30 or 40 cents a kilowatt hour that we have no solution in sight for them today. Maybe we do 5 or 10 years from now, but right now the only short-term solution is an outright minimum subsidy to the consumers. And I'll get to the changes we made in that program, but that other 3.5% would go there. The idea, the theory being that okay, some areas of the state are going to make out real good. They have a feasible energy project. They get low-cost energy. Well, how do those areas of the state make out that don't have a project? And the way they make out, to some extent, is through the Power Cost Assistance Program, which would bring them down to a lower cost than they are now. It does not necessarily bring them down to the cost the other areas would receive, but it would lower them substantially below what they're paying now. Then when we get to this 500 megawatts sometime in the future, which maybe would be estimated to be, say, 10 years from now or more or less, then the rate would become an annually determined rate that would equal, the rate would be set not at a fixed 5%, but a rate, say, higher or lower or at the same rate that would equal one, the same items, the cost of operations and maintenance and debt service and safety inspection and the annual cost of the Power Cost Assistance Program. When you run out the financial projections in the early years, well, right now, obviously, we have no projects in mind. We appropriate money today, so the Power Cost Assistance Program would have to be funded to the general fund just as we did last year. As the projects come online, then they will start picking up more and more of that, and the general fund won't have to. And then at some point, you'll cross over. And one of the things here that I think the reason you need the rate to probably float at some point is that you're talking about 5% of a fixed cost. Well, inflation is going to run up operational costs and maintenance costs and the cost of Power Cost Assistance Program in the future. It may take more than 5% on that fixed base. Because in the future, 10 or 20 years from now, you'll be paying 5% of a very deflated number. And 10 or 20 years from now, $100 million may not look like very much money. And so 5% of that might be very small. So the legislature, the rate would be set annually by the power authority to reflect what is required for them to collect by the statute here. The legislature would then, in either case, at the flat 5% or at some other different rate, would have to appropriate the money, both for the operations, maintenance, for all purposes. The money would go into the general fund. It would not be automatically recycled by the power authority. It would have to come back to the legislature for annual appropriation. That is the basic mechanism there. Maybe I ought to stop there and let people ask questions before I go on to some of the other provisions.
Question, Mr. Moss?
Mr. Chairman, I have looked through the bill here. Don't get me wrong, some of the comments I'm going to make, I'm for this power business, but I do have a little concern in the fact that we're creating power, we're going to have lots of it, but I've got a problem in a lot of my areas. How do we get it out to the people? Is there anything in here that provides us some manner in which we can put in distribution lines? I have people that have homes that they've got a main power line going right over their house, and yet it'll cost them $16,000 to $26,000 to get part of that power into their house. I looked through this bill. I can't find anything in there that addresses distribution, and it costs $77,000 to $87,000 a mile for three-phase line for distribution. Maybe I'm looking in the wrong place, but I would like to know, Mr. Chairman, or maybe Representative Gardner can tell me, is there anything in here that will reduce the cost of the distribution lines to the people out there? I have some 50 to 60 miles that we need right now in my own district for distribution lines to use some of this power. We can have all the power in the world, but if you can't get it out there, it's going to be like cream. It's going to sour. And I hope that before this bill gets through the legislature, that we've got some means in there that will give us the means to distribute this power that we're generating. And I like these bills, the energy bills, I'm all for them. But I want to get some of that energy out to some of the people that do not have it at present.
You understand the question?
Yeah. Yes, the money could be appropriated to the fund for those type of projects. They say all the projects would have to be specifically appropriated to. There's not, a lump sum of money that's just for distribution or for hydro. For instance, there is money appropriated to this fund in the tune of $76 million for the design acquisition of right-of-way for
the transmission line between Anchorage and Fairbanks. There are other sums appropriated in here, for instance, for a transmission line from the Petersburg-Wrangell-Tyee project to K. There is money to run power lines for other projects that are separate appropriations, and they're appropriated to the here. There's also, for instance, you can read through the appropriation and see the specific project. So it's not specifically listed as distribution lines. I suppose that bill could be changed if there's concern about that to say distribution lines, but it's not prohibited. In fact, we did make many appropriations for the kind of project.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, if I may continue. This is my concern. It's transmission lines from one point to another, but there's nothing that I can tell. Maybe I missed it somewhere in the bill here and reading it through real fast, and the other look that I've had at it. I don't see anything for the distribution out to the individual consumer that would help the cooperatives or whatever the power company is that has to get the power out. It costs you $2,300 a
pole in my district right now to distribute 220-volt power out to some of the homes out there. I need power in the ag projects. I need power along the highways. As I said, we've got main transmission lines between the Healy Power Plant, for example, going to Fairbanks. I've got people that are 20, 30 miles away that could open up more of the land and the territory if we could get some power in there. They're running generators right underneath the daggone main transmission line from the main power plant. It's costing them $600 and $700 a month just for diesel to run these generators, and yet they've got power that keeps their does a lot of buzzing right over the top of their house, and they can't touch it because, as I say, it cost them $2,300 a pole to put that line into their house. This I hope somewhere in here, this bill, when it goes out of the legislature, it will alleviate some of those problems in distributing the power out. A lot of the villages, for example, that have some people that are living a little further out from the main power plant. How do we get it out to them without it costing an arm and a leg to them? Those are the questions I've got, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, one of the recommendations of the Resources Committee for appropriation request was a $10 million appropriation to the Alaska Power Authority for rural electrification loans. We had a lot of laundry requests of specific projects. It was hard to tell which ones should go and which ones couldn't. It was hard to define what the demand was, so we recommended a lump sum appropriation of $10 million that then any of the utilities or projects that Mr. Moss is talking about would be eligible to apply for rural electrification loans. And we felt that we needed to set the money aside, otherwise, one large urban utility could, suck up the whole thing that was specifically designated for rural electrification.
Mr. Chairman, if I may continue. I'm well aware of the $10 million, but do we have the enabling language in this bill here that, for example, if I remember correctly, it was either House Bill 20 or House Bill 21 that that would enable some of the cooperatives or some of the power companies to borrow money at a low interest rate to put these lines in? This $10 million, I hope that it will be specified specifically that that's what it's for and not to build an intertie between Anchorage and Fairbanks or some other big area. But for the actual distribution, I don't know where the language is in here. This is what I'm looking at, Mr. Chairman.
It was our feeling that the money could be appropriated with that designation to the existing power project revolving loan fund in the Power Authority. There is an existing power project fund that we have been appropriating money to for some years now for various projects. It was our feeling that $10 million could be appropriated for rural electrification with that designation to the Power Authority within their existing fund. There are bills in the legislature that specifically would create a whole new program and a new separate fund administered by different people, and you could do it that way. But there was the thought that we could use the existing revolving loan fund within the APA.
I'll stand for a while, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I'll need it. Hey, Mr. Chairman. Terry, could you go over how this part of the bill is intended to work? Again, for my benefit, I'm starts section 490, starting on page 4, and then running into where it runs to it. The so I can get, I read it, but I so I can get an understanding of what the Resources Committee intent is in this section, sale of power from power projects.
Okay, again, the power authority, the state would, through the power authority in the power project, would own the projects. Okay, now, the projects could be leased out for operations to a qualified utility, and I'm just going to look for that section. Okay, which is 480B. When a power project has been acquired or constructed by the authority, project may be operated for the authority under a contract or lease entered into by qualified utility and the authority. Okay, well, whether it's leased out to a qualified utility or not, you have, for instance, a good example. Let's take Snedisham here. The federal government, you know, owned and built that. They sell electricity on a wholesale basis to a local utility. So let's take a case like that so it's not confusing. All right. Starting immediately with the passage of this bill, that local utility would pay, let's take a case, which is fairly close to Snedisham, $100 million project. Okay, that local utility that is purchasing that electricity, regardless of how much electricity they would purchase, that was an issue debated in the committee a lot, whether it ought to be based on how much they consumed or not, would pay a flat 5% of that total investment that the state had in the project. Okay, in this case, $100 million. They would pay that, okay, up until such time as there was a total of 500 megawatts worth of capacity acquired or constructed by the authority. Okay, at that point, it would not be a flat 5% anymore. It would be an annually determined rate of not less than 5%, but an amount that would equal the formula starting there, equal the cost of those designated programs or designated expenses. One, operation, maintenance, and equipment replacement. Two, debt service costs, if there were any. The only way there would be debt service cost was, say, if the project had been built by revenue, partially by revenue bonds or previous loan or some previous bond sale or something like that. There could be cases like that. For instance, say Solomon Gulch. There's already been federal money put in it. If we were, money were paying off that loan, that's where that comes in. Third item would be safety inspection investigation of the power project by the authority. And fourth, the annual cost of power cost assistance. So that rate would be a minimum of 5% or a rate set to equal the cost of those listed items. And the power authority would annually set the rate then to equal revenues necessary to pay for those expenses. And as I said, that's going to change from year to year. And especially it's going to change as if inflation, as we know it now, continues. I think you have to expect that you've got a fixed asset there, cost, and you're paying 5% on it or whatever rate you're paying, and yet your expenses will be going up. Okay, then the authority transmits the money, which is received, to the general fund. Okay, the total amount. He doesn't take some off the top or anything first. The total, whether it's 5% or some different rate, goes into the general fund. Okay, then the legislature appropriates that money back. Okay, and the first item it would appropriate money for is for operation and maintenance of the facility, which is estimated on an average to equal 1.5%, but again, it will vary from project to project. Okay, then there's the two other categories there, of course, the debt service, safety inspection. In most cases, there won't be any debt service, and amounts for safety inspection, that kind of thing, will probably be a pretty small amount. And the remainder then would be appropriated by the, maybe appropriated by the legislature to the power cost assistance fund. So that would be the mechanism by which it goes. Okay, then we go back to the one other distinction, sort of caveat on the whole thing, on this 5% or the flexible rate,
is that if the legislature by July 1st, 1986 had not appropriated $5 billion to the fund, then the 10%, then the rate would go from 5% or whatever, from 5% to 10%.
There's not, I don't see any likelihood that we would have 500 megawatts of capacity by 1986. The earliest projected date I've heard is 1992.
Well, a couple questions on that. On page 5 and 6, subsection B, 1, 2, and 3, in subsection 3 it's clear in the, when you get down to A, that the wholesale power rate is, would include the operational cost of the facility, but in subsection 1 and 2 there, it appears that the wholesale power rate would return to the authority 10% or 5%, exclusive of O&M costs. Is that what it's intended to do?
What do you mean exclusive?
Well, for instance, it says shall return to the authority, let's take subsection B2 on page 5, a wholesale power rate that would return to the authority not less than 5% of the amount which the authority has invested in the project on state funds. So that we got 5% plus operation and maintenance costs, equipment replacement or whatever, reflected in the power rate. Is that right?
No. So it would just be a flat 5% would be deposited in the general fund, and then the operation and maintenance would come out of that 5%.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Two other questions. One is, how was the 500 megawatts arrived at? Why is that a number better than, say, 1,000 or 200? And the other is, how is the 5, you mentioned how the 5 billion was arrived at, I think partly, but is that supposed to include the cost of building the equipment? The 5 billion?
5 billion was what was projected, that was a figure established in the Senate bill, and that was their feeling. And probably the it would be better to ask them exactly how they came up with that, but I'll try to recount what would be testified and explained to us. Basically they thought that they were, establishing a very beneficial program here. And of course not all the projects are ready to go or in the same status. And, in fact, we don't want to create sort of that hysteria like it is a one-time shot. Everybody's got to get in now. And so, we would try to have continue the normal process that we're doing now. We kind of inserted food building, that engineering design, and then funding for construction. And so they wanted to ensure that this would be an ongoing program, not just a one-time deal where those people who got
projects now would suddenly have got theirs and they wouldn't be too interested in the energy problems of other areas of the state, and the appropriation requests that would be similar, say, to the ones before us now, next year, or in the next 5 years. And specifically, I think they are concerned that the Susitna project, because of its magnitude and expense and the time it will take to do that project, is not online for construction at this date. And so this would give them some assurance that the legislature, future legislatures, and other people who would receive appropriation projects would be retain their interest. The 500 megawatts reflects a similar thought. When you look at what 5% would raise, the Power Authority ran out various scenarios at 3%, 5%, 7%, 9%, and you looked at what you've got to take in to cover operation, maintenance, and the power cost assistance program. And there's a sort of a crossover at some point. If you have 3%, you might not ever have a crossover. 5% you do after something on the nature of 500 megawatts. I mean, you can pick 400 or 600, but you have to get up to a certain volume of capital investment before there would be enough return off 5% to fund the power cost assistance program above the operation and maintenance cost. At one time, we actually had a higher figure. We did lower it to 500 megawatts.
Do we have any idea in those projections of what the wholesale power rate would be at 500 megawatts to cover the items that are envisioned after that generation capacity is reached?
Up to 5%.
That's but, I mean, in sense to fill water, mills, or whatever.
Yeah, I think we do have that. I'll get that for you.
Would you like to have Mr. Steve join you up there? It would be easier, more convenient.
I don't need that right now. I didn't know. If you have it, that's fine. I have one of the questions here.
One thing is that you know it would vary from facility to facility.
Depending on the operating costs. One other question in the section of the bill on pages 3 and 4 that's entitled Revenue Requirements. Okay, on page 4, subsection B between lines 4 and 15. It says that a project is feasible if it provides a better cost-benefit ratio than the existing system. But if there is no system, it's feasible if the cost-benefit ratio of the project is better than a power project that burned diesel fuel to generate power. So, under those conditions, what happens if, in fact, diesel fuel is the most beneficial from a cost-benefit ratio in a district or an area or region of the state? How do you determine it is feasible? Because it almost seems like the language in B excludes that from ever being feasible by law, not by cost-benefit. So how does that work? How does it tend to work? You see what I'm talking about there?
Yeah, I think it was
second sentence in subparagraph sub B. What if you run the numbers?
Section 420 on page 2 specifically provides that fossil fuel, including natural gas, are can be constructed under it. And also in terms of the feasibility of these projects, what we retained was the existing criteria in the in reconnaissance and feasibility process in the Power Authority statute.
This is a new line.
Yeah, and this is new language in addition to the existing requirements in the statute. I don't know, you could be right that it could be read that way. One of the concerns here is that you've got existing consumers who are going to be on the power cost assistance program out there. So you somewhat have to analyze, okay, they want to build a project out there, and it may be cheaper to continue the power cost assistance to them rather than to build some project out there. And on the other hand, it may be cheaper to, because of the cost of the power cost assistance subsidy, to build a project out there. And that's one of the reasons we got into this whole section, was trying to get into that. We ran into all kinds of scenarios similar to what you're posing. And that's how we came up with this section, because we didn't want to preclude projects because people were on power cost assistance, but in terms of a system-wide viewpoint, it might be better in the long run to construct some project out there, whether it's diesel, hydro, or whatever, rather than to continue the subsidy program. But I'll take a look at that. You may be correct.
Well, the only suggestion I had on it, it says the language where it says generates electric power in the area by using diesel fuel, say something like, which generates, you know, that electric power in the area at the next, you know, lowest cost-benefit ratio. But anyhow, it looked like an anomaly in the language as far as I suppose.
Thank you.
Mr. Adams?
Yes. I haven't had a chance to study this bill also, Mr. Chairman, but
the purpose of this bill, I hope, is that the intent of the legislation here is to bring equalization of electrical rates throughout Alaska closer together? Is that a purpose?
I think that is the purpose of this legislation.
Then don't you think that perhaps that the priority is backwards, that in the rural areas where we're paying between 44 and 48 cents a kilowatt versus perhaps 10 or 12 cents in the highly populated villages like Anchorage, that perhaps the intent of this legislation is backwards, perhaps that we should be looking at energy projects in the rural areas to bring it lower from 44 cents to 12 cents by developing either natural gas, geothermal methods, wind, or other power production methods. And that perhaps once we get these in place, that we can place in a percentage to lower the cost of Anchorage, Ketchikan, or Juneau. Because of the fact that you see in 1992, if the power cost assistance is repealed, do you feel that Ketchikan, Juneau, Anchorage, Kodiak would be willing to assist communities as Shaktulik, Anaktulik Pass, Kwikluk? You see that we have a problem in this, that this is going to be repealed in 1992 once the high-powered villages are taken care of, high-populated villages are taken care of.
I think what you pointed out is absolutely correct. And I think the only thing I would say to that is that even if you're correct, one of the things that we have to do is not only have a short-term program, but a long-term program. There, I think the only immediate thing we can do with, you know, say 100, 200 rural communities out there that are paying you know, somewhere from 15 to 50 cents a kilowatt hour is provide them some subsidy to let them get by until we get some alternatives in place. I do think that in the appropriation bill we have taken into consideration every possibility there are to reduce energy costs in the rural areas. For those areas where we have identified projects that are ready to go and can be constructed, those were funded. Probably one of the best programs in terms of energy cost, not just electrical cost, is the what was at one time called the Burton program, and that is one of the appropriation requests. Besides many other alternative projects funded, so I think that you know, I don't disagree with anything you said. I think we do have to appropriate for those projects that aren't done, get on with the planning for those areas where we don't know what the alternatives are, for those areas which we don't see any alternatives, that we've already done reconnaissance study, we're going to have to do research and development work, and I see those as all parts of the long-term plan. But in the short run, I think the only thing you can do is a power cost assistance program that's funded by general fund money, which with the recommendations in Senate Bill 25 is greatly expanded over last year. In fact, the cost of the program is about double of what it was last year, about $8 million.
If I might continue, Mr. Chairman. One of the things is you know, they say equity, that the place that we're getting the funds to do this comes from the North Slope, and the funds belong equally to everybody. And I just wondered if the fact that all of this, once we build the dams, that perhaps that one half of that amount is going to be spread in power cost assistance to assure that the rural areas are taken care of, because all we have today is a commitment by this legislation that will continue until July 1st of 1992. The fact is, in the future, I don't know how the legislation or the body is going to be, and that scares me. The question I have, is it possible for municipalities that have good dam energy projects, dam, that's D-A-M, projects, do they have an option to either get a state loan or do they have to participate in this particular bill? The reason I say this is perhaps it would be easier for good projects to get a state loan instead of go through this particular House Bill 25 because of the different regulations and the unknown factors that this particular bill has not been followed through yet for the future.
Yes, they do have the option. The legislature could appropriate the money to the existing power projects fund, and under the terms of that, money could be loaned out under the existing power project
revolving loan fund rather than be appropriated here. In this proposal, all of the projects that are go online under construction are appropriated to this fund. If you appropriate it to the other fund, of course, the loan payback would be paid back into the general fund and would not be subject to the this program, which would provide that some of the funds we use for the power cost assistance program.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Carney? Mr. Holker, did you have a question you want to ask?
Well, I have something that might amplify what Terry was doing when he explained the section on cost-benefit ratio. I think he did say that the reason was that if you took just a flat cost-benefit effect and tried to apply it across the board without taking into consideration that we're, in fact, paying power production assistance on the inside, then you might find that a project was non-feasible, where, in fact, when compared to the cost of providing power production assistance, even a project that's marginal, if there's no subsidy involved, becomes very definitely feasible in an alternative to providing year by year $200,000 or $300,000 in power production assistance to that area. And this thing, I do kind of agree with what Representative Malone said. I think it's poorly drafted, and I think possibly the way to say that. Well, implied. I think the way to cure that might be to drop the middle sentence and change a couple of words in the last sentence, so that you'd have just a basic statement in the first part of B that's the cost-benefit ratio, and then the authority shall determine the cost-benefit ratio by considering all direct and indirect benefits and costs attributable to the power project, which can be given a value in money, and the cost of government financial assistance for the existing system. And that was the object, was to provide that there was a little easier chance to get a feasible project in a rural area because you were comparing it to providing power production assistance virtually forever.
Mr. Rogers?
Yeah, I concur with Representative Halford's point that on the rural projects, comparing it with the cost of power production assistance seems like a better test if that's what we're going to do. I've got a number of concerns about the bill, and I'm sorry that I missed the beginning discussion on it because of the conference. But when we say this is the energy program for Alaska, and then the whole thing deals with electrical energy, which is approximately one-fifth of the energy used, could be even less than that, I don't know, something like half is the energy used is in transportation, and between 20% and 30% is in heat, I don't understand how we can say that addressing one-fifth of the problem is the energy program. And I think that when we start looking at the difference between urban energy problems and rural energy problems, we realize what we really need is several energy programs for Alaska, that no one program handles the whole thing. So that'd be the first comment. And you made the point in answering that under the old system, under a loan, the money would go into the general fund and wouldn't necessarily be used to pay power cost assistance. And this, with this bill, the money would go into the general fund and is intended to be used for power production cost assistance. That's no difference. It still goes into the general fund. It still takes an appropriation of a future legislature to put it to power cost assistance.
I think that's a valid criticism, and until you change the Constitution, I don't know what I can do about it. And I think that there is no way that this legislature is going to mandate that in 1995 the future legislature do anything we want. And I think you're always going to have that danger with any idea. I think that we were well aware of that. And there was a suggestion, in fact, by some rural people that they didn't want the power production assistance program attached here. That's fine to me if that makes people in rural Alaska feel better. I just think that legally and constitutionally, this is about the limit towards as far as you can go to guarantee it, other than you could appropriate money to, you put $500 million in a fund or $100 million in a fund and use the interest off it to pay for power production assistance. I don't see that happening, but it's a valid criticism, but you're criticizing the Constitution rather than I think anybody's intent.
Mr. Chairman, my criticism is that it's even in here because it's a false, it's a promise. It's an implied promise of future legislatures, which they may or may not do, and that's right. The same whether or not there's any language in the bill, so why put the language in the bill? I guess that's my point.
Mr. Chairman, if people would feel better by striking the language out of the bill, they could, I think that
could be appropriate, but I don't think that that is going to solve the problem.
Mr. Chairman, has there been any discussion of the wholesale power rate structure issue? I have a few questions that I don't completely understand how that would work. Get into that. It says that the wholesale power rate structure, until is that each project pays annually 10% of the amount appropriated back. Once $5 billion has been appropriated, if $5 million is not appropriated, then it's 10%. If $5 billion is appropriated, then it's 5% until we hit 500 megawatts installed capacity, and after that it's the authority's rate or the legislature's rate. So we start out with several projects coming online, and they're each paying 5%. And suddenly we hit the magic 500, and then it's no longer 5%. And I guess my question is, why should those projects which go first pay 5% and the later projects pay this unknown rate? What's the reason for that 500 megawatt trigger? That's number one. And number two...
Mr. Gardner, would you care to sit up at the table? You're perfectly willing to do so. As a matter of fact, you can come right up here and sit down beside me, and I'll duck in behind you.
No, that gives me a thrill.
Each year, those early projects pay the 5% until we reach 500 megawatts. Once we reach 500 megawatts, the wholesale power is computed by the authority or by the legislature, if the legislature decides to start setting power rates. And my question was, why do the early projects pay 5% and the later projects pay this unknown rate? That was the first question. The second one is that 5% includes operation and maintenance. So there seems to me there's no incentive to try to hold down operation and maintenance costs by building a project better to start with. You know, often you see that trade-off when you build any capital project. Maybe it costs you a little more to build it, and then you end up with lower operation and maintenance. And it seems to me that we would want to keep an incentive to build the projects right the first time so that operation and maintenance costs are kept down. So that would be my second question, is why 5% exclusive of O&M?
First of all, it's not less than 5%.
Right.
And at one time the draft said 5%, then up or down after that amount equal to the rate. One of the problems you have with fixed 5% on a fixed capital base is inflation and other things are going to change your operation, maintenance, all your other costs, including the power cost assistance program. I mean, theoretically, I would like to think that in 10 or 20 years we get some energy systems in place in the rural areas that would reduce our energy costs so we can phase out that program. It does sunset out anyway by statute. But that may or may not happen. But anyway, even if there's less people on it, who knows how much it's going to cost 1992 gallon of diesel and check to it, or wherever it is. So that's one reason I think that you want to leave some flexibility, because you're going to have increased costs somewhere out in the future relative to this fixed base. That's just bound to happen. The problem with incentives is you've got two sets of problems with incentives, and by putting in this fixed rate, you sort of favor one over the other. One of the problems is the desire not to keep a lid on construction costs. I mean, one of the biggest problems is that people could overbuild projects for their needs, or they could just go, well, the state's building this, who cares what it costs, and not be careful about the construction costs. Now, the 5% based on the total cost gives them some incentive, because the more they up the construction cost, the more they're going to have to pay back on an annual basis, right? So that's when, under the old system, of course, you had some kind of market test and you're paying a lot more than 5%. 5% is about equal to a 1.5% loan. Okay? All right. One of the amendments that the Resources Committee considered and defeated was that it be 5% based on the percentage that you consume, right? Because there's also this problem, well, what about consumption, right? We don't want to encourage excessive consumption. So the argument was, well, then only pay on what you use, right? Otherwise, if you have a fixed cost, people are going to consume more because they got a fixed annual payment on the capital cost, right? But it's sort of like a two-edged sword, you know? If you go that way, then what incentive do you have left to keep the total capital cost down? So you got two or three different incentives that you need to try to take care of at once.
Well, it seems to me, though, you want to have some sort of a balance between the holding the construction cost down and holding down the operation and maintenance. And in a market situation, the two would be combined. But since we're doing away with a market situation, it would seem to me you might want to say X percent to return capital costs plus the operating costs. So the two would tend to balance each other rather than as it is now. It seems like there's no incentive to keep O&M below, keep O&M down.
It's very simple to do that, and I'm not sure anybody disagrees with you. That idea, there will, given facilities, whether no matter how efficient they are, will vary. And they calculate the average O&M costs are going to be 1.5%. I mean, you could change the bill and have no financial impact and merely say the charge shall be 3.5% plus operation and maintenance, and then it'd be whatever it is, some facilities pay one way or another, and it wouldn't accomplish the same purpose. But you know, after you have 500 megawatts, you basically achieve what you're talking about anyway, because the rate would be set to reflect the actual cost.
The O&M cost.
No, O&M
plus
debt service, safety inspections, and power cost assistance program.
And nothing to pay back. Nothing essentially, no return on capital.
Well, there's nothing in the bill structured towards the return on capital.
Well, except that on the early project, they pay 5% and maybe 3.5%. Of that 5%, 3.5% goes for operation, maintenance, and power costs, and the other 1.5% is return on capital, right?
Yeah, but until you have 500 megawatts, the state will be picking up power cost assistance part of it through its general fund.
Mm-hmm.
5% would pick at the point you have 500 megawatts, 5% is estimated to cover O&M plus power cost assistance. That's where the 5% came from.
One more question on this, Mr. Chairman. There is a provision on subsection F, page 6. The legislature may by law annul or change the wholesale power rate for sales of power. What the hell is the legislature going to be doing setting power rates?
I'm sorry, I was too much. Okay, what's the line where you're
at? When you get the line, page 6, line 26. The legislature may set power rates.
Well, I think there's some concern that maybe we have the runaway power authority who is out there. If the
Sharp and amendments had gone through and they could build nuclear power plants, maybe they were out there charging more rates to make money to nuclear plants, or God only knows what spiritual things might happen, the legislature might want to step in and do something about that. Or maybe they were, the opposite would happen, they were succumbing to the public pressure and not setting the rate high enough to pay to run the facility. And the legislature was having to cough up out of the general fund, and the legislature, realizing the situation and not being so worried about all that might say, well, look, we need to set the rate at a rate necessary to run the project right. So I think the legislature has that power with it, right in there as well.
Just one more question. Would this bill preclude, the old system was that we made loans to utilities who wanted to do it. Could a utility who has a project that doesn't want to have, I mean, what this does is essentially now that it's all state projects, no more local projects, as I read it under this. Could you still have a local project under the old loan program?
Right. All the legislature have to do to have the, we did not repeal the existing program. The existing program is in place. We don't want to be under this. All you have to do is get the money appropriated to the other fund and you can go on your merry way.
But if you did it through the other fund, you wouldn't get the lower unit rate once the legislature comes in and does its annual political, well, we're going to lower the price of power at this year's giveaway, starting once we hit 500 megawatts. It just seems to me that this is really set up to centralize state power, and you lose a lot of your local control
a project, you lose there's a real incentive not to build a project as a local project, instead to build it as a state project. And it seems to me that's some of the worst centralization of control that the legislature's considered in a long time.
Didn't that have something to do with the Golden Rule, Mr. Rogers?
But it's carrying it to its logical extreme.
I think one thing that you might consider, though, is that under the old program, the committee was putting in the measure of the program.
But there was a measure of local control.
Further question, Mr. Rogers? Not Mr. Malone.
Mr. Chairman, just a straight question today. In this mechanism that would that's envisioned in House Committee Substitute to Senate Bill 25, what are the major policy, decisions? What were identified as advantages over this approach than, say, a 0% interest loan or a low interest loan where the authority would just on any feasible project make a loan or retire the project debt or project appropriation through the equivalent of a zero interest loan or a low interest. What were the major policy advantages of in the say 5% equity return for the setting of the wholesale power rates past 500 megawatts in terms of the payback that the state gets? I suppose is that you can always tap the power projects for annual cost of power production assistance programs. Are there others?
I think that the major difference is under the loan approach for each project, for each community, more or less comes into the legislature and see if they've got the juice to get an appropriation through cover energy costs in their area. What this does is set up a state program for energy costs. We've only got the first half of the bill, right? The building project, we haven't got the power cost assistance program.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things under this is the only way that basically communities can get reduced cost of power is to build their own project. Under this system, every project has an impact on the energy cost if it's a statewide system, because money that's coming off equity is going towards the power cost assistance program in the area. So you're not necessarily faced with, each community has to lobby for its own project. In fact, that may continue if the rates are not equalized. For example, Adam suggested that if you're still going to have rates of 12 or 15 kilowatts out in one area, and those areas that have projects are going to pay 7 or 8, there still will exist that incentive to get your own project, regardless whether it's economic or not, just to get state money because it's such a good deal and has such a cheap rate. I think that's about the only basic difference between, I think, policy-wise, how it is going to form system and operate or this system. But I think maybe the main difference is that there's some middle ground between what the grant approach of the Senate and the
Mr. Kim, Mr. Moss, Mr. Gardner, we have some people in the audience that wish to testify that have to catch a plane. Would you mind coming up and have a seat or whatever you want to do? Mr. Chairman, I'm supposed to be in the research committee, but I'd be glad to come back when the committee needs me. Okay. And go through the rest of it.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Gardner.
Would you care to come forward, Mr.
Ballin? I believe you had someone else there.
And Mr. Krantz, he's the Vice Mayor of Wrangell, and Harry Sundberg is a member of the Palisade Park.
Please identify yourself for the record and go right ahead with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman,
committee members. Thank you very much. My name is Dick Ballard. I'm the president of the Thomas Bay Power Commission, the volunteer group of commission members representing the communities of Wrangell and Petersburg. This is our joint effort between these two communities to develop our High Lake project. I'm here today to support Senate Bills 2526 and Senate Bill 244 and the committee substitutes that are before you today. I realize this is the first markup on the bill and it'll probably take some quite a different final form. There's probably a few things in that legislation right now that I could suggest changing. But more importantly to you is the fact that we have got to have this bill this year. I probably have to recap a little bit for some of the committee members where we are today and what we have been doing in the way of power development. And some 5 or 6 years ago, we started out with our lobbying efforts to put the Water Resources Revolving Loan Fund legislation in place. We were successful in getting a 5% earmarked money out of the permanent fund to go into the Renewable Resources Fund and so on. Since that time, each year at the legislature, we have come before various committees and we have proposed what we felt would be our cash requirements for that year, and we have proposed various amendments to our original legislation. 2 years ago, we wound up with a piece of legislation that we felt that these communities could live with, and that was a simple 3 to 5% loan fund, loan directly to the utilities, and the utilities would develop their own power projects. There was some thinking at that time that the state guarantee of the loans was going to be an unequal distribution and so on. But what I perceive to be one of the real reasons is, at that time, the money market was in such a shape that the bond buyers, the money managers that had been working on state financing for a number of years could see themselves losing out on the massive financing of the grand total of these public projects. That group of people, having more legislative experience, more lobbying experience, more abilities than we have, successfully last year got the legislation restructured and a new tact taken into consideration whereby the state would come up with a subordinate loan fund and then we would go to the bond market for the rest of the money. At that time, we were convinced that financial mechanism would not work. The bond market is so volatile today, and the interest rates are so out of whack. When it comes to the capitalization of these projects, there's no way any one of these projects can go to the bond market themselves. If this legislative body put 40% of the cash on this table, there's no way that private bond market could provide the other 60% of our cash requirements to these projects. I would submit to you that we went into the legislature this year with a lot of optimism, a lot of enthusiasm, that we were going to come out with some energy legislation. We've been stood off like we have been every year. We find ourselves in the waning days of the session. I have the fear that the legislature is going to adjourn out from underneath us, and that we're not going to wind up with a project this year. As one member of the House put it recently, I read in the paper, the bill that was brought over to the House from the Senate, when it came out of the House Resources Committee, it really turned out to be a House Bill 60. As I say, we can live with that because we're up against the wall. I submit to you that Ketchikan is not the only project in this state that has funding requirements for this year. We have Terror Lake, we have Tai Lake, we have continuing engineering and feasibility studies going on Susitna. Our project is going to be licensed the 1st of September. We have that in writing from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. We're going to bid next month on our tunnel and our powerhouse excavation. We've already went to bids on our turbines. And if
we don't secure financing this year, we're going to lose at least 9 months on our project because we won't get that contractor in there and get them mobilized. The total cost of our financing of our project, the total cost of our project, the subordinate loan money we received last year, $15 million towards the total cost of our project, $70 million. The total cost of that project, inflation has eaten up about $8 million of it already.
When the interim financing needs was solved for the Swan Lake project, and believe me, I'm as enthusiastic and supportive of the Swan Lake project as anyone in this state. That community needs it as urgently as any other community needs their project. But when that interim financing was solved, it afforded the Resources Committee the opportunity to delay the getting their bill out of committee and before this House Finance Committee and onto the floor of the House. It relieved sufficient pressure on that committee that we're going to wind up at the end of this session without a bill and we're going to adjourn and go home. We think we've taken positive steps in power development in this state. We've worked long and hard. We've stepped backwards the last 2 years. I was before this committee last year when this subordinate loan scheme came up, largely proposed by the money managers and the bond buyers. Like I said, because they was afraid they was going to get froze out. And I was making my normal pitch for full funding of these projects in accordance with the bills that we had worked hard to get before you. At that time, I was point blank told to forget it. It wasn't going to happen. Well, that was a true statement because it hasn't happened yet. And we're still going to have these communities. My community, talking, this gentleman over here talked about 42 and 43 cents out in the villages. We're paying 22 cents right now. And that's in southeast Alaska, and it's 90 miles away from a tank farm in Ketchikan. And we have got to have this money this year. There's more than one project in this state. Terry Lake, Tidy Lake, Swan Lake, all of them. We need it.
Let me start this before the questions start, Mr. Mallard. I understand your problem. If it hadn't been for just a sort of a fluke of the interest rates, in case you'd forgotten that, last year, Ketchikan was all prepared and ready to go and pay 7%. That was the absolute limit they could go. And they were prepared to do that with the loan and everything else. When the interest rates went crazy, they couldn't make it any longer. I'm well aware that that one project in Ketchikan is not the only one in the state. If it were, we wouldn't have a bill before us that has $560 million involved in it, the state's money. I don't think that your fears are quite that well grounded that we're going to go home without some kind of a bill. Have to do it. I've said publicly, and you've probably heard me say it, that any solution that we come up to with power, to the state's involvement in power energy, is going to have statewide application. I've told the people at home that we're not going to be able to, the Ketchikan legislators, are not going to be able to come up here and rip off the money that they need for Swan Lake and forget everybody else. That still applies. And until we can reach some kind of an equitable situation that will address the energy problems of all the people of the state, we're not going to have a bill. But I think the People and Resources Committee have admitted the bill is not letter perfect. It probably needs some amendments, and I think we'll do that. But it's not my intention that we should go home without a bill. Now, unless you want to respond, I'll... The gentleman has some questions. Mr. Malone, I think, was first, and Mr. Rogers.
Just one question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Ballard, do you prefer a direct loan program with reasonable interest rates to the program that's outlined in House Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 25?
Mr. Malone, this late in the session, my options have been taken away from me. I have to support this legislation that's before you, because we're not going to accomplish a direct loan piece of legislation when we did have one in place and it was taken away from us. The fact that the direct loan provisions still lay there in the Water Resources Revolving Loan Fund legislation that was left on the books, that's kind of a blind pig, because that legislation has been gutted so bad that we couldn't live with it and we couldn't get the necessary amendments things into it this year. And we'd still be in the same position that we are right now. And our hands are tied. We've got to support this in one form or another.
Mr. Malone.
Well, if your hands weren't tied, would you prefer that?
We always did. That's what we worked on for 5 years.
Thank you. Mr. Rogers, that was what I was going to follow up on. What was the interest rate that you were prepared to pay on your project?
The legislation said 3-5% and it was the discretion of the Commissioner of Revenue and some of the other commissioners in the Alaska Power Authority. In other words, the ability of the project. Various projects, because of their geological differences and distances from their distribution centers and the construction variables, various projects meet the test that is required at different levels. Maybe 30-cent power is the most efficient and feasible power in a given location than it is the other. Just our two projects, 90 miles away from one another. The installed kW cost on the Tai'i project versus the installed kW cost of the Swan Lake project is 50% because of construction and terrain variable.
Given a choice today between the direct loan at 3-5% and the resources committee substitute.
I mean, if we were able to get a loan instead, you'd take the loan, is what you're saying.
If I could walk out of here with that written in blood, yes.
Okay. That would mean that essentially you would continue to control the project locally instead of it being completely done by the power authority?
Well, the original legislation had either way. It would be local or Alaska Power Authority. In our particular case, we had previously opted for the Alaska Power Authority to operate it under the previous legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you know what the interest rate is that would... at which your project would be feasible? Was it 4.5% or 5% on Tai'i?
Well, it comes to present kW cost, we had several financial scenarios worked out. Mm-hmm. We had a 3, we had a 5, we had a 7, and so on. And then starting at 3%, it brought in 14 cents per kW power. 5%, it went to 17 cents, and so on. We got as high as 31 cents under a 10% financing scheme.
Seems real high for hydro. Why does it come in that
because
high?
Of that terrific front-end development cost. Our project's a remote project. It's 40 miles back in the hills. It's got 30 miles of marine cable. It's got some 40 miles of overland.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tunnel and a lake tap. There's no dam involved. And every project has to stand on its own because there's so many construction variables involved. Mm-hmm. Our project is a 30-megawatt project for 50% of the installed kW cost that the Swan Lake project is. But the Swan Lake project proved to be feasible for other projects in the area. We didn't look at our project lightly. We studied Thomas Bay, we studied Anita Lake, we studied Conks Lake, we studied
Virginia
Lake. We studied every project in our area. We came up with the one that was the most cost effective and the one that best met the test that the legislation required it to meet.
Further questions, Mr. Ballard? If not, Mr. Hoffman.
Yeah, just one. In order to maintain the, I guess what's been referred to this project, it's sitting in blackmail clause.
Now you cannot if it's sitting in the
current clause. Okay, that's fine. I'd rather refer to it that way myself. But in any case, if it came out with, and if, again, we're talking in some pretty late ifs, but if you could go 3.5% with adequate funding to build the 500 megawatt capacity versus 7% if that weren't provided, would that work?
At this point in the ballgame, Mr. Representative Halpern, you could extract any kind of an agreement out of me. You can.
Yes. Well, I tell you, we've been at this thing. We're in our 7th year. We worked 5 years on one piece of legislation. It took us 2 years to lose it, and we're sitting here at the table with nothing. So I'm going along with anything that we can get that project and keep it on schedule.
Well, the question was, you know, the uncertainty that you got in the 10% return and the 5% return, I guess, would probably be the same as the uncertainty you get.
That's
in
true,
the interest
but we've got some unknown figures in our present. We're 100% diesel-generated community, and we're operating 20-year-old engines that are ready for replacement or repair. We've got some distribution problems, and we've still got the unknown factor of the future oil prices, even though it just didn't stabilize here in the last...